From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. A few months ago, when Alberta Premier Danielle Smith took a series of trips to Florida, she faced criticism from many Canadians for spending taxpayer money to meet with far-right political figures in the United States. And even in Alberta, which has long been Canada's most conservative province, the story blew up. But as a mainly provincial political issue from the other side of the 49th parallel, it's not something that probably would have crossed my radar. But then I saw a clip of David Shepherd addressing the issue.
Mr. Speaker, standing on stage to shoot the sugar with Ben Shapiro isn't courageous, it's conceited. This isn't a trip to promote Alberta, it's to pump up the Premier's ego. This fanatical fundraiser for the far right isn't a lion's den, it's a conservative love-in. It's a conspiracy-loser, a full-on QAnon Republican, the opposite of learning man, where conservative nerds of a feather come together at $1,500 a plate to support rolling back women's rights, whitewashing slavery, and denying climate change. Yeah. No, the Premier's actions aren't noble, but I suppose they're novel. She's certainly the first provincial leader to ask a hostile foreign head of state to just pause their attacks on us to help elect a leader more willing to play ball with their unhinged demands. The first to attempt and fail to stop a tariff war with a campaign of selfies and high-end cocktail parties. The first sitting Premier to audition for a job with Fox News, all on the public dime. It's ludicrous. It's ridiculous, but you know what? It's not funny. It's embarrassing.
Shepherd's speech to the Legislative Assembly of Alberta went gangbusters on TikTok, Blue Sky, and Facebook, bringing cross-Canadian and even global attention to an issue that might otherwise have gotten more limited and regional attention. And today's show isn't about this specific political issue or any of the others to which David Shepherd has increasingly become known for addressing with an oratorical baseball bat. It's about how Shepherd uses the nuances of language to engage audiences and make points in a time in which attention spans are ever shrinking. It's about the art and science of speech. David Shepherd has served in the Legislative Assembly of Alberta for 10 years, representing the people of Edmonton. And in addition to the attention he's gaining for his rhetoric, he's also got a very impressive collection of bow ties. David Shepherd, welcome.
Thanks very much, Matthew. Very happy to be here. Appreciate the invitation.
David, you're a first-generation Canadian. Your mom's from the Netherlands. Your dad's from Trinidad. Talk to me a bit about growing up in Edmonton, which has diversified a lot in the past few decades, but did not look like it does today back then.
No, it definitely didn't. And I'll be honest, my upbringing was not terribly diverse either. You know, as you said, man, both my parents immigrated. So they met here at a little church in Edmonton for my dad. When he was about 16 years old in Trinidad, he converted to Christianity, became involved in a church there. And that really became his culture and his community. He kind of gave up everything to do with his Caribbean culture and Trinidadian tradition. And that's what I grew up in.
And this was a fundamentalist Christian church, yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
A very white congregation?
Absolutely. I knew very few other black people growing up. I think there was one other family that had a couple of black kids. But it was very homogenous, I think, in largely in terms of worldview and culture. We were not allowed, I was not allowed to listen to the radio. I wasn't allowed to go to movies. We were very limited in what we were allowed to watch on television. So it was a very limited scope of the world that I got. The one thing that I did sort of get to explore was reading. The one thing my parents didn't pay much attention to were the books that I read. So I would take out the maximum number of books at the library, every 2-3 weeks. And I was a very quiet, very introverted kid. So most of my time was reading or playing with Lego.
What did you like to build with your Legos?
Pretty much anything I could think of. You know, it's just one of the things I've learned about myself is I love possibility. So, you know, with Lego, it was just kind of like I can make anything out of it. I always have loved having pieces of things and figuring out how I can put them together to make something else.
When you're a kid and you are fairly constrained in what you are allowed to see, you are aware, though, that you are different in, you know, some aesthetic ways from your peers. How does that process in a young person's brain in Alberta?
I think I was aware on a certain level that I was very different from my peers. You know, I, like I said, I was pretty introverted. I struggled a lot socially. I did not understand kind of how social rules were supposed to work. So most of my life was very, very interior. I don't know. I guess I kind of just adapted to that. I focused on the things that I sort of felt I could do to prove myself. So I was very good with academics. You know, I went to piano lessons when my parents sent me. I didn't particularly enjoy it when I was studying classical, but I went and just kind of and focused on a lot of the church stuff. I was a kid. I tried to memorize the most Bible verses. I tried to, you know, be the keener kid at Bible camp on all of the challenges and everything, right? So that's kind of just what I guess I focused on to express myself.
You mentioned piano. At some point, you immersed yourself in music, but you just said that you didn't enjoy, or I guess always enjoy it much. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, I started out in piano lessons. I would have been probably like 6 or 7 years old. I can't remember exactly when. Studied Royal Conservatory Classical up until I was 12 or 13 years old. I think I took my grade 6 Royal Conservatory exam. But no, it didn't mean anything to me. I didn't particularly enjoy it. But, you know, after that year, I got sent to a new piano teacher. And she sat down with my parents and said, look, David's not that good at classical. Why don't you let me take him out of classical and I will teach him a bit about playing by ear. And so that's what she did. And I remember I went in there for, you know, one of my first lessons with her. And she said, okay, well, you know, do you sing this particular song at your church? I'm like, yeah, we do. And she's like, okay, I want you to go home and figure that out. And that clicked for me. Suddenly it was like, oh, this is kind of like that. This is like my box of Lego. I can take pieces and I can put them together. I can figure things out myself. So it locked into that creative impulse in me. And that is when I started to love music.
It's very interesting to know you were this very, you know, socially anxious kid, very shy, didn't really know who you were. And then you end up in this career in music, playing with bands, and then also in communication. This is pre-politics, but I mean, these don't seem like the kinds of careers that some kid who's socially anxious goes into. So what's the transitionary point there?
To a certain extent, I felt more comfortable on stage than off. You know, I felt more comfortable, you know, being on stage than being in a crowd of people. You know, like I remember just going to, you know, going to a few parties during that year I was away at Bible school, and it's just torture. It was hell. You know, I don't know how to act. I don't know what to do. I don't know. I feel intimidated going up and talking to people. I don't know what to say when I'm there. I seem to be awkward. Nothing I seem to do seems to be right. On stage, I get to create the moment. So I've got a written speech. I have watched people on stage. And so I know what that's supposed to look like. I know how to act like a preacher. I know how to act like a rock star. I know the show I'm supposed to put on. And even though, you know, in those early days, you know, a lot of that would be very scripted, maybe it would have been kind of forced, it was at least I had a template, and I could never figure out the social template for just dealing with people. It's in these spaces where things are unscripted, where at least for me, I could not figure out what the template, what the rhyme or the reason was, that's what caused me stress.
Do you feel like you still struggle with that? Like, do you prefer to have that template, to have that stage, as opposed to, I mean, even a situation like now? We didn't discuss these questions before you came on today. Like, is it more comfortable for you to have that stage?
In some respects, yes. I have certainly learned a lot about myself and a lot more about why I am the way I am, how my mind works. And that is part of a challenge for me. Yeah, I do better in situations where I have at least a modicum of structure. Now, I get a particular personal thrill from the state of improv. That's part of why I loved being on stage. It's part of why I've loved playing music. It's part of why I love the work that I do now, debate on the floor and that sort of thing, because I love that creative challenge. I don't know what's coming at me.
What pulled you toward politics?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, what pulled me into politics was a changing of the guard here in Alberta. So we had one premier step down, Ed Stelmach, and then a race for a new premier, and Progressive Conservative Party of Alberta had been in power for at that point coming up on 40 years. Right. So it's my lifetime. Right. They took power in 1971. I was born in 1973. So my entire life, they had sort of been the government. So folks were frustrated, said, well, we can't change the party, and obviously never going to vote them out. Maybe we can get a more progressive leader. So they all got lined up behind this woman, Alison Redford, who went on to become the premier, and again, a major disappointment. And so at that point, I kind of went, huh. You know, I'd been involved in some community advocacy. I'd done some stuff on the condo board with my building and discovered I was a decent enough organizer to sort of pull people together. And I thought, huh, someday I think I want to run. And I want to win provincially. That's where I feel the issues line up. And I want to do this because people are frustrated. People are disengaged. And people are tuning out. And as long as people tune out, then nothing is ever going to change. You know, the can't swear on air. The jerks get to keep running the show. So I decided, you know, I want to get involved. Was pretty convinced I'd be in opposition. But, you know, let's see if we can't show people that you can talk about politics differently. You can do it in a way that's genuine, actually engaged in the community, and maybe start to rebuild some of the faith in the system to actually move towards a place maybe where someday we can start to see some change. And I had a great system set up with multiple streams where I could actually track a lot of stuff, so I could learn a lot from it. And I started seeing the news stories, and I forget the timeline about which was first, but there was just a number of shootings of young Black men in the States. And I was following those stories, I was reading it, and just it was starting to click for me. I was going, okay, these are people that look like me, who have history, who come from like cultural backgrounds like I have, but who have had very, very different lives than me. And I wanted to learn more about that. So I started following some Black activists and Black journalists and following these stories and just trying to learn. So I was trying to catch up and educate myself on all this cultural history, all the stuff I missed and how all these systems work.
This feels like it must have been like drinking from a fire hose. Like there was a lot for you to learn in a short amount of time during this period of your life.
Yeah. I mean, at that time, too, I was also going to school. I was doing that online while working full time. So essentially kind of two full time gigs. So it was a lot. But the thing was, I was struggling with some fairly serious health issues at the time that made it pretty limiting for me. So I did not go out much. I did not have a lot of social interaction. So it gave me a lot of time to just sit and read. So, you know, yeah, it was a fire hose of information, but I was in a space in place at the time where I was kind of receptive and had the room.
Okay, so how do you go from this person who is having some health issues, not really able to go out very much, to getting yourself elected to the Legislative Assembly of Alberta?
So 2014, I finished my BA. Once I finished that degree, all of a sudden I had like 20, 25 hours of time back a week. And I was like, what am I going to do with it? You know, one of the ways I'd been trying to get out and sort of rebuild my social contacts and social life had been through working with the bike community. I was a year-round cyclist at that time. It started out because it was financial necessity, but I also enjoyed sort of the creative challenge of that too. And sort of
in the place where you live, that's hardcore.
Biking through the winter, minus 20, all that. Absolutely. Right. There was something that felt satisfying about, you know, overcoming that. But so I got involved June that year in sort of a public relations campaign for cyclists in Edmonton. There was a lot of conversation around bike lanes, a lot of pushback. So I worked with some folks in the local bike community. I put out an online survey, collected the stories of a bunch of local cyclists, got a photographer, take a bunch of photos. And yeah, for the month of June, I set up a blog and we published the profile of a cyclist every day. Just sort of like, hey, these are the people that are out there cycling on the streets. Maybe if you know them, you'll be a little more considerate of them when you encounter them on the road. Got a little bit of media attention for that, and that kind of went well. And then from that, started getting involved with the group, the Edmonton Bike Coalition, that was advocating for funding for a particular cycle lane that had been pledged to be built but was not yet funded in the upcoming city budget. Worked on that campaign through into the fall, spoke at city council, sort of ended up becoming the de facto media spokesman with that. And then that was successful. And so then I found myself sitting at the end of the year. I had applied on some jobs with the Alberta NDP, a political party that I now sit with, because I wanted to work in political communications. Didn't get a call back. You know, they didn't know me from a hole in the ground. So I ended up reaching out and offering to volunteer. I said, okay, well, if they won't hire me, maybe I can volunteer. And I met with one of their organizers in December of 14, and they said, hey, you're doing some community advocacy stuff. You're kind of involved in some things on the ground. We think we're going to have an election next year. Would you be interested in being a candidate?
Wait. They didn't hire you, but they wanted you to run.
Now, you got to understand, at that time, the Alberta NDP was a party with four MLAs. So it had had some strengths earlier on. Like, I mean, coming in the late 80s, they were fairly strong as an opposition, but then they got completely wiped out in the election, I think in 91, 92, not a single seat. So they had been slowly rebuilding. And at that point, they had four MLAs in the legislature. So for parties like that, when you're in that position, you don't get to be too particular, right? And that's why I originally said no. You know, when he said, you want to be a candidate, I was like, oh, no. You know, these guys, I get it. You know, you need to have somebody be the name on the ballot in Fort Saskatchewan or something. You know, and I was like, no, when I do this, I want it to be a real run. And I want to run in the community where I live. So a few weeks later, I had actually signed up to volunteer for one of my current colleagues provincially. But at that time, she was running federally, Janice Irwin. And so I signed up to work on her campaign to get some experience on political comms. And at one of her volunteer training events, I met David Egan, who is one of my colleagues now, who was one of the MLAs then. And he said, well, you know what? We're looking for someone at Edmonton Centre. I said, oh, okay. So that kind of twigged me a little bit. And he's like, oh, well, let's go have coffee. We'll talk about it. And so when I talked with David, he was like, you know, hey, don't worry about it. You're not going to win. Because the person who held the seat at the time, MLA Laurie Blakeman with the Alberta Liberals, she'd held this seat for 18 years. And so David said, look, you know, I ran against her before I ran, you know, in Edmonton Calder and won. You know, one of our other MLAs ran against her before he ran in his seat and won. You know, you can just do it this year. Get a little bit of experience. Get a taste for what this is like. And then you got 4 years. You know, she's likely to retire in the next election after. You got 4 years, build your name in the community, and then that's your chance to take your real run. So I just started a new, brand new job with the city of Edmonton. I had a lot of other stuff on my plate, but I'm like, okay, I can make enough space to do that. And then we had what, you know, we had a sort of just groundbreaking election. The PCs decided to try to run early, get ahead of the drop in the price of oil. And we had what was called the Orange Wave, right? People just finally got enough of the sort of arrogance and entitlement, you know, that comes in with the party that's held power for 44 years. And as folks said, you know, the Alberta NDP was the only party that had their pants on. So we found ourselves, boom, in 2015, I found myself elected as the MLA for Edmonton Centre as part of Alberta's first NDP government.
And when that happened, you became just the third person elected to the Legislative Assembly of Alberta ever. I mean, the numbers there are just staggering, right? I think you said somewhere, wrote somewhere, there's like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who served in that assembly over time. This is not a small body of people. And there have been three Black people.
Yeah, at that time, yeah. And that was something I learned after I was elected. Because like I said, I did not grow up with any significant sense of my Black identity. You know, it really was, it was after I got elected. And all of a sudden, I started getting invitations to all these events with the African Caribbean communities, Black communities, you know, here in Edmonton, that all of a sudden I kind of sat up and went, wait. And I looked at it and said, yeah, there's only been two Black people elected before me. And I'd go out to these communities and to their events like, wow, we've never had an MLA show up here before. And that's kind of just clicked for me. Again, my brain is trained to look for possibilities. And what I saw there then was, wow. We've got all these communities who have never been politically engaged before. And I'm here and they see me and they see someone that looks like them. I'm like, I have to do this. I have to make this a commitment. So I sat down with my staff, you know, at the time we just started working for me. I said, okay, we will never say no to any invitation to an event with the African or Caribbean Black community. And that kind of started building from there.
There is a really great tradition of oration from Black politicians, from Black Canadian politicians like Jean Augustine, Lincoln Alexander. How much did that tradition inspire how you thought about the way that you would use speech as a member of the assembly?
It might sound strange to say, and this is not me sort of trying to stroke my own ego or anything, but I can't recall ever having a conscious thought about imitating someone else's speech. I never sat down and went, oh, wow, that's a great public speaker. How do they do that? That sort of thing. It's something that just developed for me instinctually. Now, I think without question, I was absorbing stuff from around me. It just wasn't conscious. And just when it came to music and a lot of other things, I just my mind just works like a sponge. I just take stuff in, churn it up, and kind of stuff comes out. So, you know, I think I listened to a lot of preachers growing up, obviously. And obviously, I had a fixation on performers, you know, from all the music and all the rock stars and, I mean, all the Christian rock, all this stuff that I was always kind of taking in. And I guess it all just kind of coalesced in this melting pot of my brain, and I just developed my style.
Yeah. I mean, like the way you speak on the assembly floor, it's often, you know, to me, to my ear, it's like slam poetic, but it's also, it's rhythmic, it's lyrical, it employs a lot of wordplay. I mean, it's very musical.
Yeah. I do think very much in those terms. I think about, you know, how I modulate my voice. And yeah, I mean, the wordplay and all that, I mean, I've just always loved language. I was the weird kid that loved writing essays. So I developed quite a vocabulary pretty early on. And if there's anything that I sort of look at in my speaking now, sometimes it's kind of like, okay, maybe I choose words sometimes that are a little too academic, but I guess it's a style that works for me.
You also employ humor. You've done this to pretty good effect through like this really interesting juxtaposition of humorous wordplay and pop cultural references and then very serious subjects. Why do you think that works so well?
It's been interesting. So, you know, when we got knocked back into opposition in 2019, and frankly, the government at that time, I mean, you know, the current government, it takes it to whole new levels, but that government at that time was pretty arrogant and dismissive as well, right? And just, you know, attack, attack, attack. And I thought a lot about how do you counter that, right? How do you get around that? How do you get through that kind of ego, that bombast, that negativity? And where do you find strength? And it struck me that being quick on my feet and the ability to use humor, those are powerful ways to sort of puncture the political ego. Historically speaking, that has always been true, right? I mean, it's been the court jester, it's been the satire. It's that has, in some respects, you know, helped to bring down, you know, dictators and empires, because there is no defense against it. When folks wield power, and when they wield it indiscriminately, when they wield it arrogantly, you know, it only works as long as people continue to buy the myth, as long as people continue to feel intimidated and afraid. You can't be afraid of someone when you're laughing at them.
David, there's pretty decent scientific evidence. I think also we can all point to anecdotal evidence in our own lives that human attention spans are shifting. But if it's harder to hold on to people's attention now, and yet the issues we need to address are as complicated, maybe even more complicated than they've ever been, then being able to capture and hold public attention through these things that you do is a really important skill. So I guess my question here is, like, why do you think so many politicians are still so bad at it? I mean, we have some great rhetorical speakers out there. We have some entertaining orators, and then we've got a lot of people who are struggling with this skill.
Well, success in politics, does being a skilled rhetorician help in politics? It absolutely does. Is it in and of itself going to get you elected and keep you elected? No. There are so many other aspects to this work, to being required to be successful in this. So that's all of the fundraising, that's all of the networking, that's all of the volunteer recruitment. It's there's a whole other system that has to exist, right? I mean, I'll be honest, you know, yeah, I do this work and I do it the way I do it to try to engage and educate more people. Is that in and of itself enough to sway the vote in the next election to put us back in government? No. If I had not been where I was, if I had not stepped up at the right time when no one else was interested in running in this seat because it seemed like such a long shot, if I had had to go through a competitive nomination race, given the challenges I had and the lack of a personal network, the ability to fundraise, all those things, I probably wouldn't be here. So the opportunity that I have in this work to use the skills that I have is an incredible gift. But there are so many other pieces involved here that are required to continue to maintain this and be successful in all the other aspects. And it takes work to create creative communication. to have a creative mind, you have to keep feeding in new information. So I need to have time to sit down and read a lot. I need to have time to sit down and absorb different things and just take things in by that process of osmosis to keep refilling the bank, putting fresh stuff in the bag of riffs. And if all these other pieces of the work eat up the majority of that time or dominate that, then that ability starts to go away. All that to say, I guess it's tricky. You know, it is an important and incredibly valuable skill set, but it requires then having other systems and things in place that provide the space to be able to make use of it.
That's David Shepherd. He's a member of the Legislative Assembly of Alberta, where he represents the people of Edmonton. David, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the chance to come on.
Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, let's say you're in Canada, you can still listen to us every episode wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support our work, you can do so at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Dassault. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.